A new report from the United Nations says humans are unequivocally to blame for climate change and its devastating effects. So what are we going to do about it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Avon, Colorado, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, August 9th. Good, as always, to have you along. I read the new UN climate report this morning in the haze of smoke from wildfires raging throughout the American West. The report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change spells out in no uncertain terms that human activity has warmed the planet, that we've waited too long to avoid devastating consequences, and that the effects of climate change are already being felt in every region of the globe. Climate scientists say a dramatic reduction in greenhouse gas emissions could still prevent the worst outcomes of a warming planet. Here in the U.S., the transportation industry has a big role to play. It's the biggest source of emissions. Last week, we talked about President Biden's plans to get more electric vehicles out on the roads. But there's also a lot that needs to happen to get cars off the road. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher has more.
Transportation makes up 29% of all U.S. emissions, and most of that comes from cars and trucks. Elizabeth Irvin with the Union of Concerned Scientists says people who rely on their cars need to have other options.
One of the things that's really critical for folks feeling comfortable giving up a car is being able to have confidence that the transit is frequent and reliable enough to get people where they need to go.
In Ontario, Oregon, for example, Catalin Plummer is not able to get where she needs to go on public transit. She lives in a rural county where cows outnumber people 5-1.
It would be nice if I could just, you know, hop on the bus to go to work.
But her town's one bus doesn't run frequently enough to make that viable. The infrastructure bill that's before the Senate right now does include $39 billion for public transit to upgrade and expand bus systems, transit stations, rail. The White House stresses that this funding is in part directed at communities of color, especially since many of those communities both rely on public transportation and don't have easy access to it. Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institution says that is a historic investment in transit, but it's going to take even more to convince people to change their ways.
Not only to make sure they ride transit more, but to use transit as well as biking and walking as an effective way to reduce all the climate impacts from all of our local transportation habits.
And that, he says, will take a much bigger investment. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
As employers and employees grapple with return to the office plans, so does the commercial real estate industry. The brokerage Cushman & Wakefield is placing a bet that one solution to all that vacant office space out there is co-working. The company announced this morning it's forming a partnership with WeWork and plans to invest $150 million in the company ahead of WeWork's second try at an IPO. The announcement follows similar deals by office space giants CBRE and Newmark. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains what all this means for landlords, tenants, and the endangered species formerly known as the office worker.
One sign that depriving cubicles and coffee makers of human contact for 17 months isn't good for the office space market? Just take a look at the deals you can get on a New York City sublease, says Alex Cohen, a commercial real estate broker.
You could pay 50% of what a tenant is paying.
One option for landlords to cope with the rough market, lease to a co-working company, if they're to be trusted.
They have a reputation in light of the last 3 years of being a very risky proposition.
Some co-working companies have gone bankrupt or tried to get out of leases prematurely. Traditional real estate brokerages can lend credibility to co-working firms by shacking up. But the bigger reason behind these deals? Companies looking for office space aren't looking for long-term commitments, says workforce consultant Callie Yost.
Instead of investing in long-term leases in satellite locations, they will have more flexibility in terms of co-working spaces around that headquarters location.
Whether they're going the co-working route or not, building owners are desperately trying to make the office seem less like a place you have to go to and more like a place you want to go to. Once again, commercial real estate broker Cohen.
You see landlords adding restaurants, adding gyms.
Gyms could be enticing. Another excuse to keep wearing basketball shorts during the workday. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, Mondays, am I right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you missed it before the weekend, there was some good news for people with federal student loans. The Biden administration has extended a pause on payments and interest for another few months. Borrowers had been looking at resuming payments and accruing interest this fall. With this final extension, if it remains final, they now have until February, at which point they will have received almost 2 years of emergency relief. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looks now at what that's meant for some borrowers.
Not having to make student loan payments has been a game changer for Krista Pekacek. She's 23 and lives in Seattle. And before the pandemic, she was paying about $400 a month toward her loans.
I couldn't put any money in savings. And I couldn't move out of my parents' house because I couldn't afford rent anywhere.
Now, Pekacek has been able to move out. And she's paid down a bunch of medical debt.
It's so much more financially stable without those payments.
More than 40 million people have federal student loans, and most of them haven't had to pay a cent since the pandemic began. And just as importantly, their loans haven't been accruing any interest. Betsy Mayotte at the nonprofit Institute of Student Loan Advisors says normally a lot of them are dealing with 6 or 8% interest or more.
Those are the people that are like, you know what, I've been paying for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and because of the interest, I just feel like I'm not getting ahead.
That's been the case for David Sorrell. He's 35 and lives in the Bay Area, and his balance for federal and private student loans has been around $86,000 for a decade now, even though he's been paying around $900 a month. With his federal loans on pause, Sorrell's been aggressively paying down his private loan.
The monthly payments are usually about $100, and I was able to kind of triple that.
And he's finally seen the balance start to go down. Betsy Mayotte at the Institute of Student Loan Advisors says she's been hearing from a lot of borrowers that a permanent interest rate reduction might be almost as good as debt forgiveness. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
If you miss a day of Marketplace, don't worry, we've got you. Check out the Marketplace podcast on the platform of your choice. The number of homeowners refinancing their mortgages jumped again last month as average interest rates fell back below 3% for a 30-year loan, and as regulators announced the end of an adverse market fee imposed on refis by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. More than half of all loans made last month were refis, according to data firm Black Knight. One reason homeowners refinance is to cash out some of the equity they've earned, but how much equity they have depends on a home appraisal. The Biden administration has formed a task force to look into discriminatory practices in the appraisal industry. Junia Howell is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Research she and a colleague have done shows that comparable homes in predominantly white neighborhoods appraise at 3 times the value of those in Black and Latinx neighborhoods. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How does discrimination show up in home appraisals?
Yeah, well, when we say the word discrimination, often what we think is individual decisions or behaviors or biases that negatively impact a certain population over another. And that happens in appraisals for sure. But the bigger story when we're talking about racial inequality in appraisals is actually not so much about an individual appraiser's decision as much of how the system or the way that we appraise houses more generally is structured or arranged such that we have historically and continue to give more value to white spaces and white homes.
And some of that is baked into the system we have of using comparable sales, mm-hmm. right, to estimate property values. Can you talk about how that perpetuates historical patterns?
So comp sales, for anyone who's not familiar with it, is the process of using recent previous sales to help determine how much a property is worth. This is the primary method that we've used in our country for appraising for almost 100 years. And what it means is that you're constantly pulling past sales to help define how much the current sale should be. And so that means that we have historically pulled redlining and processes of racial discrimination in house prices into the present. On top of that, often appraisers define what's similar to your house based on the racial composition. And so in two ways, both the historical pulling and the contemporary use of defining areas based on race continues to perpetuate racial inequality in home prices.
So as much as the system drives a lot of this inequity, it also comes down to human bias and just simple decision making. I was struck that even something as seemingly objective as floor space can actually vary quite a bit appraiser to appraiser.
Yeah, that is something that really surprised me, because it's not something that I would have expected either. I definitely came in with the bias that like square foot is square foot. But what we see is there's a lot of different ways that you can measure square footage. And there's a lot of different ways that appraisers pull square footage. So you see one house appraised by six different appraisers will have three or four different square footage. For most appraisers, it's a key indicator in how they compare the comparability between the house they're looking at and those comps that we were just talking about. And so when the square footage is off, it actually can make big differences, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars in some cases, on how much a house is worth. And so part of what we are pushing for as scholars who are looking at this and at people in the appraisal industry is standardization. Ways to standardize some of these processes so we're taking out the inconsistencies and the biases that we're seeing throughout the process.
So we've seen property values rising rapidly across the country, given the tight supply of housing. But I'm wondering how this equity gap in appraisals is contributing to differences in both, you know, the building of wealth, but also in the loss of wealth as protections for homeowners who can't pay their mortgages expire.
Yeah. So this is something I am currently super fascinated by. Not only has home values skyrocketed, the racial inequality between those home values has also increased. And so what you're seeing in the pandemic is partly a lack of housing, right? So we've talked a lot, there's a lot of reporting about how we have less housing, why that is, why construction is down, et cetera, et cetera. But we still have more square footage of housing per person in the U.S. than we've had for decades. So we are also buying bigger homes. More and more people have two or three homes. That's happened in the pandemic. To the story about it just being a lack of construction, a lack of space, is part of it. But I would argue the bigger part is because we are giving more and more access to credit and thus the ability to accumulate wealth and buy these homes to affluent individuals and predominantly white individuals, while we're not giving that to everyone else. And further disjuncted or discontinued the true relationship to like the need to live and be in a home from the actual space, because it's become more about investment and credit than it has about the need of housing.
Junia Howell is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
it's like driving a little roller skate.
Getting a feel for the past. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 106 points, 0.3% to finish at 35,101. The NASDAQ added 24 points, 0.1% to end at 14,860. And the S&P 500 shaved off 4 points, essentially flat, to land at 4,432. Matt Levin looked at the commercial real estate business, so let's dust off the cubicles to check out firms in that sector. CBRE Group lost 1.4%, and Cushman & Wakefield was off 2.7%. Sanderson Farms, one of the nation's largest poultry producers, has been sitting on a fine little nest egg with sales that rose more than 34% during the second quarter. That made the company a tempting takeover target. Cargill and another privately held company formed a joint venture to acquire Sanderson for about $4.5 billion. Sanderson cooked up 7.4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We'll get fresh data on the pace of home building next week. New home construction grew by more than 6% in June as builders struggled to keep up with demand for houses. We've talked about how recent shortages of lumber and steel and other building materials have slowed much needed construction. But the demand is also helping revive an industry in Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has that story.
It's been a tough past decade for Minnesota's forest products industry. The housing collapse in 2008 contributed to the closure of three plants that made oriented strand board, or OSB. That's a plywood-like product used to build houses. A few years later, a fire destroyed one of the state's largest paper mills, and other plants and paper mills have either closed or downsized. That's why a lot of Minnesotans were really excited when a North Carolina company called Huber Engineered Woods announced plans earlier this summer to build a $440 million OSB plant in the small town of Cohasset.
It's the biggest deal in 40 years since the last mill was built in Minnesota.
Scott Dane is the executive director of the American Loggers Council. The new facility is projected to create more than 150 direct jobs. But Dane says it will also provide a huge boost to the region's loggers and the truckers who transport timber to the mill.
What this announcement does is gives a lot of encouragement to those who have been struggling over the years that there is something new coming. And it'll encourage them to reinvest in their businesses and commit to the long-term.
As mills have closed in recent years, the amount of timber harvested from Minnesota's forests has dropped dramatically. That's bad for loggers, but also, many people argue, for the forests. John Drimmel, who manages the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Timber Program, says a healthy forest is a diverse forest, with different species and different ages of trees. That diversity helps protect forests from wildfire and disease and provides benefits for wildlife.
Having that diverse forest is important, and our main tool to do that is through harvest and forest management.
The new OSB plant could also help fight climate change, which may seem counterintuitive. After all, trees pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So how could cutting down more trees help the climate? Eli Sagor, an extension specialist with the University of Minnesota, says when trees die in the forest, they decompose and that carbon is released.
When we harvest those trees, and turn them into long-lived wood products like oriented strand board, which is a building material, it then gets put into a building where that carbon remains locked up for decades, many decades.
And then when the trees that were harvested to feed the OSB plant grow back, they'll start sucking more CO2 out of the air.
So that then frees up that forested acreage to grow new trees, sequestering more carbon, storing more carbon, and then, you know, continuing that cycle.
But the project's environmental and economic benefits will come at a steep cost. The state has pledged more than $60 million in public funding to lure the plant to Minnesota. Mark Phillips is commissioner of a northern Minnesota-based state development agency that awarded part of the subsidy.
I'm not a huge fan of big incentives, but that's the world we live in. If you want to land a project like this, this is the kind of thing that other places do.
The company hopes to break ground this fall or next spring. In northern Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
The UK lifted most of its pandemic restrictions last month, and that's given a boost to a brand new museum. But the objects and technology celebrated in this museum are now widely regarded as an environmental menace. as we talked about earlier in the show. Welcome to the Great British Car Journey, a look back at the fossil-fueled car industry, which offers visitors a chance to relive the past. From Ambergate in the county of Derbyshire, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Doesn't sound much fun on a warm, sunny day in August, a museum, but tourist Neil Vaux can't wait to visit this one.
Because I've been to lots of car museums. They've all got the windows wound up. You can't get in them. You can't almost can't touch them. So the big difference here is there's a fantastic selection of cars that you can actually get in and drive.
The Great British Car Journey, as it's called, is the brainchild of former car industry boss Richard Usher.
So here we go. Lusting along in second gear, up into third.
He took me for a spin in a 1939 Austin 7.
Yeah, but we're whistling along now, heading for the lusty heights of 30 miles an hour.
Launched in 1923, this car was Britain's equivalent of the Model T, the first British-made mass-production vehicle, the car which put British working people behind the wheel, albeit at a fairly sedate speed.
Ooh, we're just doing 35 now, almost top speed.
Usher has more than 100 vehicles on display here in a former cable factory, around 30 of them for driving. The exhibition, he says, celebrates what was once a really major British industry.
Early in the 1950s, Britain was the biggest exporter of cars in the world, bar none. We exported more cars than the USA because our car industry got back after the war quite quickly.
Over the following 30 years, though, it was a story of slow but terminal decline due to militant labour unions and feeble management. Usher's collection charts the highs and lows, the worst and the best of British cars.
This is a piece of engineering genius.
The Mini, launched in 1959, synonymous with the swinging 60s.
The Mini is such an engaging, cheeky little thing.
How does it feel to drive, though, the Mini today? It must feel pretty clunky.
Oh, it's lovely. No, it's amazing, actually. It doesn't feel clunky at all because it's like driving a little roller skate.
And then there's the worst from the 1970s.
This is the Austin Allegro. And frankly, it just looked a bit dumpy and weird. And it was a sales disaster.
Climb inside and you can see why.
Once you're in here, you're faced with plastic of a dubious quality. The door handles are very plasticky, feel like they might fall off. And this really horrible brown colour that sort of pervades it all.
In spite of such defects, even cars like this are remembered fondly. And people have been lining up to drive these old cars around the six-mile circuit under the supervision of an instructor.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, you're just essentially stepping back in time.
It is.
You've no luxury of a five-speed gearbox.
And now elderly Ken Wheeler chose to drive this Austin 1300 GT, the same car that his father drove when Ken was a kid.
To relive my experiences as a child has been absolutely amazing.
And Michael and Jill Hannington chose the Capri, with Michael at the wheel and Jill looking on.
Yep, I was in the back seat, yep, watching him drive around, taking his trip down memory lane.
And how was it for you?
Yeah, it was very good, very good.
The Capri, a rather sporty, fastback coupe, has a special resonance for the couple. This was Michael's car when they were courting.
And that's why you went out with him, was it? Because of his Capri?
No, not at all. But he sold it when we got married, so...
The good times were over.
Absolutely, yeah.
The Brits' long love affair with their cars seems set to continue as the era of the electric vehicle dawns. Richard Usher reckons he's on to a winner. After all, nostalgia is one thing that always improves with age. In Ambergate, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, weddings are back big time. The Wedding Report, a market research firm, is projecting almost 2.5 million ceremonies next year, the most since 1984, according to Axios. This year, we're apparently on track for about 1.9 million, almost back to pre-pandemic levels. It's not clear how much of this is due to a backlog of weddings rescheduled due to the pandemic, though according to the wedding website The Knot, there's also been a rise in spontaneous proposals. Nothing like existential dread to bring a couple closer.
Alrighty, we've got to go, but not without some economic context for your Monday. There were 10.1 million job openings in this economy at the end of June, according to the Labor Department. That's another record high since the survey started more than 20 years ago. Employers also made more progress filling those jobs, hiring 6.7 million workers. And the reshuffling continues. Nearly 3.9 million workers voluntarily quit their jobs, close to a record. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. I'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.